Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mass Monologues. Today, I have with me a special guest, David. Would you mind introducing yourself? Tell us a little bit about how you got into music and what inspires you.
I'm David Andrew Weeb, and I was attracted to music initially when I was growing up in Japan. J-pop and J-rock very much appealed to me, being one of the main ones under the heading of J-pop. And then with J-Rock, it was B's. And they have something like 40 or 50 consecutive number one hits. One of the best-selling artists across the entire world that's not even necessarily well-known. So things that inspired me, certainly various artists and I'd say life events. More often than not, in the early days, it was heartbreak. That's what inspired the music.
And do you mainly write your songs about heartbreak, or is it about other life experiences, or can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. As time went on, I started having more songs about different topics. I think even my first solo project that had songs about being disillusioned with trying to live up to an ideal, songs about the contradiction, or let's say maybe the contrast of what it means to be human. Later on, I started exploring other topics like identity, being restless.
And when you've had these topics or moments of inspiration, how would you capture them? Did you capture it in your lyrics? Did you capture it in your melody, your instrumental?
Yeah, I've done it differently at different times, but I'd say in the early days, it was all about the words first and the music. And I would start with a title, and sometimes it would be very, let's say, cliche, like all or nothing. That would inspire an entire story in a song.
Yes.
So it was very easy for me to start with something cliche like that and write an entire song around it. But of course, I'm a riff writing machine.
Uh-huh.
So more riffs than I always know what to do with. And there's certainly melodies and songs that have been put to those as well.
As you evolved as a songwriter, did you find that instead of using cliche phrases, you tweak them and put a little spice to them in a sense?
I think that's really important. And I don't know how much I've done that, to be honest. I have on my recent EP, Makeshift Romance. Like, that's not necessarily a cliche or title you hear everywhere. There's some creativity to that. Perfect Nuisance, Wonderfully Dysfunctional. It seems like I like those words that are paradoxical when heard together.
Uh-huh. And so can you tell me how your songwriting process starts? I know it's differently for every song, but can you talk about one specific song and then talk about your journey from beginning to end? So tell us where you captured the inspiration and then how you turn that into a song. So did you scribble it down in a notebook and then go to your keyboard, go to a guitar and start playing a little riff on it? And then did you collaborate with music producers and then sing the vocals afterwards? Or just walk me through your process?
It's funny because you try to look back on it and pin it down, and it's almost like it just happens and unfolds organically, but there's definitely a few common things that I can pinpoint. And the first is I could be reading something, I could be doing work online, and then suddenly I'll hear a phrase and I'll go, holy cow, I think that's a song. I can do something with that. And so one little lyric will turn into multiple lines of lyric. And probably before I've even started a chorus, the guitar has somehow found its way into my lap.
Mm-hmm.
And slap the capo on the third fret. Sometimes it doesn't even make sense. Why does the capo go there? It just does. Mm-hmm. I'll start playing some chords and I go, oh, okay, like G minor, that's a good key for me. F sharp, G sharp, those are all pretty good keys for me as far as my singing voice is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So not always will that happen, but sometimes it will. And
yes,
you start playing chords, you start playing riffs. I so much avoid. Not that I don't use them, but I really avoid cowboy chords. So for me, if the riff's not inspiring, I don't always want to do anything with it. and mess around. And if I feel like I'm stuck or am I overthinking it, then it's, I know it's not happening. But yeah, it's like there's a muse, maybe not. And it's inspiring me and it's moving me to action to put this song down. So it's certainly capturing an emotion. It often is based on some kind of life experience, lyric speaking. And yeah, musically, it seems like it's coming from another place.
Are you a one-man show? Do you write the music and produce it yourself? Or do you collaborate with the music producer?
And so a lot of my songs, I will write from start to finish. I have confidence in my ability to do that. And I'm getting better and better as a producer. I think at this point, the only thing holding me back is gear. You're definitely better mixing with a proper speaker than headphones. In my be I mixed with my headphones. In saying that, like, I've had a really great connection with Patrick Zielinski in Calgary. He's a great composer, might even be someone to talk to as well, because he's taught guitar and has been producing and recording for many years now. He's excellent at what he does. So when possible, I like to work with him and collaborate with him. And he sometimes determines the direction of the song. If we're co-producing, he'll go, no more backing vocals. And I'm like, I always want more backing vocals. But it's just me.
Too much.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've noticed with some of the other musicians and singer-songwriters I've interviewed, they have a chord or a melody, I guess a melody structure that they associate with a certain genre or with a certain theme. Do you have that yourself?
Elaborate on that.
This one musician I was interviewing, he said this minor chord felt like this genre to him. I can't remember if it was like blues or soul or funk. And then in all of the songs that he wrote in that genre, he'd incorporate that chord. Do you do anything similar?
Yeah. I think the thing that happens pretty commonly with, let's say, groove rock or funk rock, I'll use the blues scale. And usually, like more often than not, it'll start off in the fifth position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the D lives. And then if you move up to your frets, it's the D. So it's just a quick jump to those kind of two key notes, right? I think it's the first and the flatted seventh.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the notes you would always use in a funk tune. But yeah, without necessarily always trying to deliberately incorporate it, if I'm trying to write a riff in that specific style or genre, it's something that comes naturally for sure.
Mm-hmm. And when you're writing melodies, do you find that you use more static melodies in your songs, or do you use more interval leaps or more ascending and descending melodies, or do you vary it for every song?
Yeah, melodies, super important. And I take most of my notes from a band called Perrin Scarum out of Toronto, but nobody knows them in Toronto, or nobody knows them in Canada even. They're mostly band in UK. In places like that. And they have a very, in a way of speaking, a pop way of pop sensibilities with their melodies. They're very consonant a lot of the time. And so for me, yeah, if a song doesn't have a strong melody, I don't like it. Yes. I need a melody to sing to. And yeah, I need hooks to be able to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally written stuff that was dissonant in the verse and then picked up in the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And that can work. But in my world, yeah, the melody's not strong. I don't know how to necessarily articulate. I think probably just because I don't have the biggest vocal range. It's mm-hmm. pretty tight a lot of the time.
You don't need a huge vocal range to be able to write a meaningful song. And I believe that's a misconception for a lot of musicians who might not be vocally the best. They're not.
Yeah.
Vocal technique isn't up to par, isn't the highest in terms of range. And I feel as though you should know that you can work with a small range. There's been musicians, singer-songwriters, even people in pop music pop music does this all the time, where they'll use the same 2-3 notes in a song and they'll just vary it throughout your verse, your chorus. And if they have a bridge, they might add in a couple of intervals, leaps in there, but it doesn't have to be anything extravagant.
Yeah, I think so too. I was at the Calgary Stampede once, and I think I was for Stampede a lot that summer, if I remember. Happened to be walking by the Coke stage when Kalen Porter was playing. And I thought to myself, my voice is not that different from that. Mm-hmm. I can do it, right?
Yes.
So it's good for us to have maybe role models or maybe just an awareness, as you say, mm-hmm. of people necessarily sing like Mariah Carey or Ariana Grande. You don't have to have that to be able to express yourself, for sure.
Yes. And can you tell us a little bit about your vocal recording process? So I know a lot of singers out there, they might be just starting the first song and they don't know how to evoke emotion with their voice. And it can be a little difficult when you don't have an audience that you're singing to, and it's just the microphone, yourself, and your music studio, if it's a home studio or if it's an actual studio with a producer. How do you envision the character you're speaking to or singing to, or just have those emotions come out in your vocal performance?
That's a great question. I feel like I have a pretty energetic approach to production, which it really contrasts with my nature, which is very grounded and calm, pretty much. But when I start playing my songs and I start recording them, I'm like, holy cow, there's so much energy here. And I don't know if I can ascribe that to any one thing. More so, get your favorite mic in front of you. Use it a lot. Maybe even use it on podcasts like this. So you start to get comfortable with your voice through the mic and playing with it. Keep messing with it. Try different distances. Add a pop shield, remove the pop shield, just try a whole bunch of things with that mic until you're super comfortable with it. And then when it's in front of you on your desk or on a mic stand, you're going to feel so much more comfortable approaching the mic and being in tune with the song versus trying to think the lyrics or melody or who you're necessarily singing to.
Yes.
If it helps, then get an audience and sing live, but you're not going to get the same quality and you're probably going to get a lot of bleed too.
Yes. So I saw on your Instagram, you do vocal performances. So you have bars or clubs or certain places you go into and perform. Can you tell us about the performing aspect of being an artist and a musician?
Yeah, I learned so many things out of necessity. That's really what it came down to. I played in a few different bands in my 20s, and it was fun, but so much of the time I was not around people who were equally as committed as I was to the process. And bands on TV or in music videos, and you think to yourself, they're amazing, but the exception, a lot of bands don't stay together. Most relationships don't work out. Most of your partnerships and investors and whatever else in life doesn't work out. Yeah. And so out of necessity, I was like, I knew how to play guitar. I could sing a little bit. I could write songs. I can't count on anyone else to be there. Maybe hire them. Maybe I can bring them in and out of the band as needed. But at the end of the day, I can't count on these other people to show up when I need them to show up near this project with me. So that's when I was like, I need to be able to play guitar and sing and communicate and have that.
Yes.
Down, right?
It's honestly taking control of your life and of your situation and realizing that, hey, I want to put this much into my music and I want to reap the soul benefits of that because I'm the one doing the work and I can't count on all these other band members because some of them might not be as invested in it as I am.
Exactly. And so my guitar playing style started to reflect that fact. Started acting as the guitar player, bass player, and drummer in one, because we usually didn't have one or the other. Sometimes neither. Sometimes it was literally just me. So I started playing as though I were all three at once.
Mm-hmm.
Not like it was super impressive or super technical, and how it was just more so like you could feel the beat, you could feel the motion, where the chord changes were. It was all pretty solid. And it took me a while to loosen up and go the other way, right?
Yes. Because
you see some of the best out there, like Prince, who performs solo on acoustic, who used to perform on solo acoustic sometimes, watch him and go, wow, he doesn't just play the chords, mm-hmm. he slicks and fills and riffs in between. And so for me personally, I had to loosen up and start throwing that stuff in there so I could show off full capabilities as a guitarist.
Yes.
And worry as much about trying to be the bassist and drummer too.
It's wonderful how technology, like your digital audio softwares, your DAWs, they enable you to have all those tracks recorded in one song. So you can sit down, play the guitar and record that. Then you can sit down, do a little take on the piano, and then you can do the vocals on top of that, play some drums. And you can basically be a one-man band without having the drum attached to your back, right? That's wonderful. I want to ask you a little bit about your book. I noticed you released a book on your website, and it was to help artists increase their productivity. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so this is my eighth self-published book.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked the other day why I kept publishing, and some people feel that writing a book is the most painful thing you ever do. But the feeling that you get on the other side of having written a full book is just indescribable. Just like the first time you put something up online, maybe your album or maybe a t-shirt or something, and people buy it the first time. It's the same thing. You finish a book. It's the same feeling when you finish an album, that feeling of accomplishment. And this eighth book, during the pandemic, I think we all got to explore the inner reaches of who we are as human beings. And one of the things that I took on was blogging daily. And so I just decided, what am I going to write about on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday? I varied it every single day. And I think Wednesdays ended up being the productivity day. That's what I talked about, how to get things done, how to keep organized, how to put together to-do lists. And I've managed to unload a lot of stuff, thousands of articles, over 500 podcasts, over 500 videos, 8 books, as I said, now 49 songs that are recorded and published. I have many more songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not including 300 shows I've played across Western Canada and other stuff I've produced or guested on. And so I felt like I had something to share about getting stuff done for, not just for artists. I think I've been speaking to artists now since 2009, I would say.
Yes.
Even 2007. And I wanted to continue down that track. And I think I was also at the same time ready to talk about some stuff that would just be equally as valuable. And people have often said that about my books, that they could apply to freelancers, they could apply to entrepreneurs, they could apply to coaches. There's just about anyone could have takeaways from my books that would be valuable, even though there are some music specific things, as there would be.
No, it's so funny how being a musician is being an entrepreneur, because you have to promote yourself. You've got to network with other musicians and singer-songwriters. So there is so much crossover and overlap when it comes to those two things. If you have any takeaways for musicians, then chances are you have the same takeaways for entrepreneurs and vice versa. It's wonderful that you wrote that book. Do you mind going into detail on a couple of the takeaways?
Yeah. And I think I managed to accomplish this in a very meaningful way in probably just the first 3 chapters. I almost give away a few key points that if people put into practice, they would really be ahead of most people. And the first one is set aside an hour of your day for your highest priority. If people really stop and think about, that's not happening on maybe any given day, is it? And especially not consistently. Artists might wait for the weekend to go into the studio to record. And instead, what I'm suggesting is set aside an hour every day to sit down and record or sit down and collaborate. Whatever your highest priority is, set aside an hour today, every day to work on it. Yeah. Another takeaway is prioritization. And I think people have trouble weighing that. Right. But if we were on any given day, you've probably got A, B, C, D, E, F, G, since A all the way through Z. You have to start to identify what is the A.
Yes.
Done. And if you dive deep into time management productivity, you will find pretty quickly, like Covey's four quadrants, the most urgent thing is not the most important almost ever. So it's it falls under the quadrant of important, not urgent. Yeah. That's the thing that you have to prioritize. So you might have like D, E, F, G. That might be where a lot of stuff lies. And A would be like prioritizing that overseas collaboration because that opportunity come around. It may not be fresh by the time you come back to it. Opportunity loves speed. Money loves speed. You have the things that are going to be the greatest return in your career.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about greatest return, what does that look like for musicians?
Yeah, you have to determine that for yourself, certainly based on your goals. And I've been a musician coach for a long time. And of course, I could tell you what to focus on if you wanted to make it all the way to the Grammys or if you wanted to tour the world, be a session player for John Mayer.
Yes.
And that's not everyone's goal, is it? And the average artist is thinking, although they need to think bigger to actually reach their goals, the average artist thinking, if I just make a living, do what I love, I'd be perfectly happy.
Mm-hmm.
You could make a living on 20K a year. Is that good enough? Or 30K a year? And increasingly, we're coming to a point where life's pretty expensive. So that means, and you might not have internet access in your home and you certainly can't do TV, but you could make it work. You know what I mean? Or are we talking, I want 50K or I want 100K. I want to take care of my significant other and my kids and my able to afford a car and all that kind of stuff, then we're talking about that's a different kind of living, right? So everybody has that point for what a living would look like. If you're not making at least six figures in New York, you're committing financial suicide.
Right.
You better have that going for you.
It's becoming increasingly difficult for musicians, singer, songwriters, artists to make a living off of writing music. Do you have any advice for musicians and singer-songwriters? Are there ways to subsist your income?
It's a strange world because I see more opportunities than ever to monetize your career. I think it might be a matter of we're going and paying a bar to go and play at their venue, hoping that somehow that lead to an opportunity. Like we're going to get signed to a record label or something like that. A, we're not getting paid for that gig, and B, it's like getting struck by lightning, whether or not anybody's going to even care. In terms of income streams, there are many available. I think for musicians, it might be worth looking at. If you're not already doing this, teaching music, I did music lessons for many years. Sometimes I still have the occasional guitar student, and I have a lot of experience in that area. Maybe you're a pretty decent writer from having blogged for a while. There's a lot of freelancing gigs. I know AI is writing more than ever, but at the same time, there's also a lot of blogs that really require human writing. Anybody who wants to get anywhere with business blogging now really requires human writers because Google's going to start deranking, and they already have. Going to start deranking AI written content. Okay. How useful is that at the end of the day? Some artists, because they love being in front of people and performing, would actually also make for really great public speakers. And there's an entire speaking circuit. There's stuff like you could start off with free and open source stuff like WordCamp and then start to explore your local business unions, associations, whatever else might be out there. And before you know it, you can start to gain some experience, some confidence, and start to be paid for your speaking engagements. Some artists have gotten really good at web design and graphic design because they've had to do it all themselves. That's another very marketable skill. It's not all about the side hustle, but I guess my point is there's more ways to make money in music than just live performance and streaming royalties.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ways that your skills that you've gained can translate into other corporate environments or startups or whatever.
It seems as though you have to leverage your strengths, right? And those strengths could be applicable to different fields other than music. And in some respect, you can also tie it back to music. So you could design a website for another artist. You could collaborate with other, maybe it's a music label that's starting up. And so it's wonderful to see that a lot of artists, they're transitioning from that narrow mindset to, I have to make a living primarily off of streams and performing and touring. And now they're branching out into other streams of income. Like it could be merchandise. It could be a YouTube channel online. It could be gaining an audience or doing work for another company, another artist.
Definitely. And I talked a little bit about this in a blog post called The Slash Conundrum. Basically, the basis is it's inevitable that you're not just a guitarist and you're not just a singer. You're not just a podcaster. A podcaster is someone with a story to tell. And right. If you're not out living and doing things, how interesting are you at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a conundrum because you can't just be one thing.
Yes.
But the pro of it is that if you can demonstrate how you're interesting and you have stories to share, you have constantly have interactions with different people, then you are interesting as a content, for example.
Some of the most successful artists in the world, they wear so many different hats. If you take Taylor Swift, for example, she writes books. She did a film, I believe. Like you have to branch out and expand. You have to get your name known. You've got to get your work known. And that could be doing all these different activities.
Yeah. And there's a timing for it. I wrote about the music entrepreneur triangle. And the first, or the basis of all of it, the base of the triangle is work. You have to become known for your work, and probably it has to be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is that one thing going to be? And you might have to test, you might have to iterate, you might have to try different things, but eventually as you strike a chord, you have to keep digging, right? A mile deep and an inch wide once you figure out what connects with not. And then the two other sides of the triangle start to form and come together. And the first one is celebrity status. That does not mean that you're famous like Brad Pitt is, or you're famous like Angelina Jolie is. It means that you have celebrity effect amongst the people in your audience, your fans. If you have that, they'll buy everything that you have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, diversification. So Taylor Swift can do whatever she wants.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have to write a book and have a ghostwriter. She doesn't have to make a film. She can hire film directors. She doesn't have to do any of it now. She probably doesn't even write a lot of her songs at this point. Doesn't have to. So the right time to diversify is after you've achieved some form of celebrity status.
In one field.
Exactly.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with your music right now and how you use your strengths to leverage your career?
I just put on an event in Victoria, BC. We called it Clean Slate. It was a gigantic experiment. We were successful in bringing together a little bit of the community, and that was a lot of fun. And in preparing for that, I put together several new pieces of content, including a book, a comedic series of videos, a new offer for my audience, and a musical release. The Make Romance EP just came out in February. That's a 5-song EP. And I was starting to think about and look at what's the cadence of release that makes the biggest difference.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at Ed Sheeran's career, not that I based my career off of him, but he's successful, right?
Yes.
He releases EPs, or he did. He certainly did and still does release new EPs every 3 months, like every quarter. And so for me, I started to contemplate, like, what would that look like? And that was all part of the initial experiment. Now, as I said earlier, I ended up mixing this on my headphones and then later realized, yeah, that really is a bad idea. It didn't quite come out with the punch.
Uh-huh.
It's just missing something across the entire EQ spectrum that really needs to be there to sound. So I planned to, this thing was not rushed, but I had a short time frame to work on it. Mm-hmm. And it came out great, but there were things that I felt like I still wanted to add. Mm-hmm. So planning on going back and adding another layer of guitars, maybe bring in my friend to play on it, Taylor in Okotoks, Alberta, and remix and remaster it just to bring out those frequencies and spectrum so that it sounds its best.
As an artist, a singer, songwriter, musician, et cetera, difficult to know when your song is finished, right? Because you listen to your song and you think, I can go back and tweak this. I can go back and edit this. I can maybe add a bit of the guitar line there. I can add maybe a chord, a pad, whatever. How do you know when your songs are complete? And how do you press up and feel as though it is all right or it's good?
It's a great question. And it's totally part of my philosophy as well. Look, I used to be a compulsive perfectionist. Mm-hmm. I was never satisfied. I felt like life's just going to pass me by if I don't start collecting and amassing and make a record of everything I've ever done. Got into the business world and it just beat perfection right out of me. And we're taught about like minimum viable product. Mm-hmm. If people that want it, why not get it in front of them now and gather feedback?
Yes.
And improve and iterate. Because even a book, people say, once it's out there, it's out there. Yeah, true. But you can create the second edition. You can create the third edition. Really not that hard as far as I'm concerned. So you can really iterate on anything that you've created if necessary. So yeah, in Dan Kennedy's words, it's knowing when something's good enough and learning when that happens. And how do you know when that happens? I think I saw this with bands like Under Oath. They would obsess over, oh, there's that, I hear that little scrape on the guitar when my hand was moving up from the third fret to the seventh fret. Everybody else in the band's, huh?
When was like, that?
Yeah. It's so chaotic anyway. What are you hearing? If you're obsessing about that, for me, it's too far. And maybe once you're at the point of obsessing over what the fans want versus what you want, it's doing. But if you're obsessing about your version of perfectionism, whatever that means, it's definable anyway, you've probably gone too far into the other side. I think we're living in an age where you don't have much choice. You either have to create a lot of content and hope that it connects with people. So quantity first, but still with quality in mind. Just only create a few quality things. There's a lot of businesses that are, because they used to have so much bloat of content, right? That was about that. The other, some things that don't have anything to do with their products, services, businesses, what they do, just for the sake of ranking in Google or getting a little bit of traffic that doesn't do anything. So we're coming into an age where fewer things that are of high quality that are applicable and specific to you is one approach that is working.
You talk about getting your songs out there. Can you tell us about the first song you released? And when was that? I'm curious. And how did you get over that fear of failure, that fear that it's not good enough, it's not up to par? What are my friends going to think about it? What is my family going to say?
Yeah, I like that. The terminology that you use, because in my world, the three pillars are getting it together, getting it done, and getting it out there. Getting it, meaning your mindset, your psychology, your attitude. Getting it together, meaning your productivity. And then, of course, getting it out there, being marketing. And so the first song, it's sort of the thing that we ended up started doing was contributing to compilation projects. So we were covering music by, at the time, Daniel Amos, not a very well-known Christian band. In fact, they were on the fringe of even that scene. So super obscure. And the fans on the message board were putting together a compilation project. And I said, I want to be a part of that. So I recorded a song with my band. And I guess I didn't concern myself too much with what people would think, but I knew like after recording it that, holy cow, this vocal is so much harder to pull off than I thought. And so we just had to live with what was what. And that didn't feel the best, but
yes,
either way, we pulled it off. We put it out there. Mm-hmm. It was fun. Learned from it. And then gradually from there, we would upgrade to digital 8-tracks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that first, and digital 8-track mixers, not 8-tracks in your car, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. First song probably would have been 2003.
Artists seem to believe that their first song, their debut, is going to be spectacular. They've got all these high hopes for it. And then what ends up happening is you release the song and it's great. It's not where you want it to be. And some artists get defeated by that, but you should know that it's your first time. It's not going to be the best thing ever, right? So you have to keep going. You've got to continue.
Yeah. Understand that a lot of people are constrained in coming from love, and something I'm realizing on a deeper level too, but really what it is, you'll have so many people say to your face, oh yeah, I'll buy that when it comes out. Oh yeah, I'll totally listen to it. Let me pre-save it. And then you find that not all those people, but maybe only 2 in 5 actually do what they say they're going to do. And the other 3 just kind of flick out. Or when you finally come to them with your album, they're like, oh, cool, right on. And then they move on to the other conversation. Maybe they're distracted by across the room or whatever it might be. Yeah, I think that recognition is really important. Your debut can be great, but at the same time, if you're not really developed as an artist and your track is not standout, stellar, superb, it's probably not going to have that type of effect.
Yes. I'm curious, what do you do with your marketing for your albums and your songs? Do you have certain strategies?
In preceding years, because I was helping so many other people accomplish that, whether it was a crowdfunding campaign or a Facebook advertising campaign or optimizing a YouTube channel, I honestly did very little for my own records and albums. And I'm changing that now. I'm more so looking to be the crash test dummy of all the strategies that are out there. Mm-hmm. If this works, I want to go see how it's done. I want to try it for myself and then see if there's any truth to what they're saying. But I would say, look, there's different strategies for different folks. There's about 3 that I recommend for a lot of artists. And the first one is Dream 100. This is, as far as I'm concerned, it might be the only organic strategy that works right now. And what that looks like is making a list of hopefully 100, but if it's not 100, that's okay. Start with 20 or start with 30. Keep adding to it as you notice. That would be influencers, blogs, musicians that you look up to, basically newspapers, magazines, basically anybody that might have access to your audience. You want to make a list of all those people, build a relationship with them. There's different ways to accomplish that, but that might look like following them on social media, joining their newsletter, interacting with their newsletter, leaving comments on their posts, buying their products, maybe even getting their physical address and sending them a package saying, hey, I really appreciate you. And I want to let you know that I'm on my way to creating something out of my music. But the framing is super important.
Yes.
So that's your Dream 100 strategy. Then there's retargeting. So in other words, if you have a really good sense of who you sound, who you've been influenced by, you can identify all those artists and use advertising campaigns to retarget those people and their websites and start directing traffic to you. Because if people like Chris Isaak and you sound like him, maybe people will like you too.
Yes.
Next one is playlist promotions. It's a really sticky, weird thing right now, because Spotify says you can't pay for promotion. And yet all these companies claim to do it organically. So as far as I know, there's no ban on it. It's not illegal. It's just something you got to do. And most artists that you see that are up to 20,000 monthly listeners, didn't get there by like playing shows and waiting around and posting a few videos. No, they paid for promotion. And then the last thing that I see, and again, there might be other things I recommend depending on the artist, YouTube. If you're really good at YouTube, it has so many opportunities for monetization. For one, you can get advertising money. Two, once you have a solid channel, sponsors will start approaching you.
Yes.
Lots of opportunity. Three, you can recommend affiliate products. Four, you can leave links to your own products.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more for me, like that's the direction that I'm looking at for myself and for other artists.
Yes. No, that's a lot of wonderful advice. I'd like to wrap up this podcast episode. So if you want to shout out to your social media channels, your website, tell us where we can find you. I'd love to hear that.
I've been mixing things up as of late, but if you go to David Andrew Weeb, WIEBV.com, that is my home for everything right now. I'm planning to launch some other stuff for musicians. I have something new in mind for that. I'm thinking about launching something for podcasters. That's how I came across you. On Instagram, I'm David Andrew Weeb. That seems like an essential nowadays. And would love it if you found my YouTube channel as well. I think the username is Dawcast, DAWCAST.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. If you like this podcast and you'd like more like this with special guests, then please share this podcast with a friend, family member, and have a great day. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you. Hear the story, say, oh, say, let